10 seconds till firing time. Mark. Fiver. 4, 3, 2, 1.
Buenas noches, amigos, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Brandalismus. Welcome to this session of Brandalismus edition November. We will continue with the Egypt, the Kingdom of the Sun. In the last chapter of Brandalismus, we were with the history of Western astrology of the ancient world by Nicholas Campion. And we were in the section of the Egypt and the Kingdom of the Sun. I am Re, I am Atum, I am the Lord of Everlasting, I am the being which upholds eternity. The sun was given different names to designate its various phases. Rising, it was known as Re, or Ra, and setting, it was Atum. Although originally both gods may have been regional deities of the whole solar cycle in their own right, the Book of the Dead spell 15 hails the sun as Re, when you rise, and Atum, when you set. The spell continues in a style which indicates spectacularly the reverence with which the sun was regarded. Hail to you, O Re, at your rising, O Atum, Horakti. Your beauty is worshipped in my eyes when the sunshine comes into being over my breast. You proceed at your pleasure in your night bark. Your heart is joyful with a fair wind in the day bark, being happy at across the sky with the blessed ones. All your foes are overthrown. The unwearing stars acclaim you. The imperishable circumpolar stars worship you. One in the horizon of Manu, being happy at all times and living and enduring as my Lord. How beautiful are you rising and you're shining on the back of your mother Nut. You have appeared as the king of the gods. Was Oracte or Aracte, meaning Horus of the horizon, or Atum Aracte, as he sank over the western horizon. As the rising sun, he was Khepri, literally scarab beetle, or he who becomes, or the self-created. Both associations had logic. Horus was represented as a falcon, a bird who flies high enough to carry the sun, while the dedication with which the scarab beetles push balls of dung along the ground resembles the force with which the sun is moved across the sky, or the fact that the beetles emerges from its own substance and is reborn as of itself. The goddess Sekhmet, the terrible ruler of war and battle, is not normally categorized as a solar deity, although the fact that her statues are crowned with a solar disk, that suggests that she was. Her lioness head is intriguing, suggesting a link between the sun and the lion, which was to be found in the Mesopotamian constellation of Leo, but otherwise not in Egyptian culture, and perhaps anticipating Leo's later Greek link with the sun. Horus is also a solar god, often identified with the Apollo of the Greek myth, but in Egyptian, Or is consistent with the word sky. Thus, Horus is depicted as a falcon-headed god, and as falcon, his two eyes are sometimes the sun, the right eye, and moon, the left eye. After the loss of his left eye in the fight with Set, the eye of Horus is also called the wedged eye, and is present today in its depiction on the back of the American dollar bill. This was not an idle story, but an astronomical allegory. If the left eye was the moon, then its loss provided a narrative around which the mystery of the moon's monthly disappearance could be told. The evolution of Egyptian astral religion in the Old Kingdom seems to represent some sort of centralization of various regional traditions as the state consolidated itself. The building of the pyramids of Giza, just outside modern Cairo, which appears to incorporate elements of both, may indicate the attempt to formulate an official national celestial theology with a priesthood base in the nearby city of Heliopolis. The pyramids should be seen as a symbolic expression in stone of the state religion of the pharaohs, and the priesthood of Heliopolis. Exactly as a mosque embodies mystical Islamic principles, or the cruciform shape of a Gothic cathedral, the salvation through the cross which stands at the heart of Christianity. Our difficult thought lies in working out how these principles were incorporated in the pyramids. Given that the most magnificent examples were incorporated, the three monumental 4th dynasty pyramids at Giza included the Great Pyramid by Pharaoh Khufu of Khufu around 2480 BCE, contained no inscriptions. The Pyramid Age began in the 3rd dynasty with the Step Pyramid of Djoser, who reigned from 2060-30 to 2060-11 BCE. Virtually ceased during the disintegration of the first intermediate period, dynasties 8 to 11, and was revived, though on a lesser scale, during the prosperous and powerful Middle Kingdom, 12th dynasty. The new kingdom of pharaohs preferred to be interred in the ground and established a communal cemetery in the Baji of the Kings, in the south near Luxor. The Pyramid Age therefore occupied a relatively brief portion of the entire 3,000-year civilization, and the great period of construction at Giza lasted only a century. It represents a particular relationship to the cosmos, as lasted as a specific in time and space, as, say, one building face at Stone Age. Whether we accept Herodotus' statement that the Great Pyramid was built by 100,000 slaves over 30 years, or the more recent view that it was constructed by 20,000 paid artisans over 20 years, the pyramid's construction represents an astonishing collective devotion to a shared view of the relationship of to the state to the cosmos. The statistics are truly a wisdom. Khufu's tomb consisted in 2.3 million 10-ton blocks and is 100 meters high, as tall as 50-story building. The granite blocks, some as heavy as 60 tons, were brought from Aswan, 1,000 kilometers away. It is the most convincing evidence we could have of a state which was immensely wealthy to supply the necessary labor, and united gangs of laborers arrived from all over the kingdom and worked in teams depending on their locality. Although there are no inscriptions on the Great Pyramid, simple archaeastronomy reveals its role as mediator between the stars and earth, the next life and this. When modern scholars did consider the pyramid's possible astronomical symbolism, they originally thought that it was inclusively solar. In fact, there is no reason why solar and stellar cults should not exist, and increasingly, the Great Pyramid is seen as the embodiment of both. It was not until 1963 that astronomer Virginia Trimble checked one of the 4 hitherto unexplained shafts, which run in an upward diagonal fashion from the center of the pyramid. 2 starts at each of the king's chamber and the queen's chamber, one pointing north, the other south. She found that the king's southern shaft pointed to the stars of Orion, the Orion belt, around 2500 BCE. The conclusion is that at the appropriate moment, Khufu's soul will be able to travel to Orion to be welcomed by the great king and judge Osiris. If Trumbull was wrong, then that tells that the precise pyramid star alignment hypothesis fails. But the fact that there is a general orientation with the cardinal direction sustains the notion of a direct relationship between the earthly state and the heavenly. The evidence that the temples were aligned with key points on the solar cycle, solstice and equinox, and bright stars such as Sirius and Canopus is persuasive. We know from the pyramid text, which first occur in the later 5th dynasty pyramids, that the king mounted to heaven on the rays of the sun. Pyramid text, utterance 508 reads, "I have trodden those thy rays as a ramp under my feet, wherein I mount up to that my mother, the living Urreus, on the brow of Re." And utterance 523, "Sky at the eye of Re." It is not difficult to argue that Orion could have fulfilled the same function at night as in the sun in the day. The point was to journey to a corporeal, not an ethereal life. In the Duat and the pyramids were the means by which this may happen. The soul, the Ba, may travel either to the sun's rising or to Orion and achieve precisely the same result in mortality. This was not otherworldly religion, though the physical world existed in partnership with the other world, the Duat. And as Ed Krupp put it, Khufu's agenda was nothing less than the stability and continuity of the world, and he exerted celestial power to fulfill it. It is also likely that Khufu was deliberately elevating his own cult as representative of the sun and Osiris, as a direct challenge to the priest of Re at Heliopolis, exactly as the heretic pharaoh Akhenaten was to do in the 14th century BCE. The Great Pyramid remaining Meyer's stellar connections appear to be a link between the southern shaft of the Queen's Chamber with Sirius, the star of Isis, suggesting that the pyramids serve both female and male aspect of the divine. It is also a simple fact that the Great Pyramid faces almost exactly due north, as was demonstrated by Sir Flinders Petrie in the late 19th century. The match is astonishing. The north side deviation from true north is out by 2.28 of arc, a figure too small as to be scarcely noticeable, certainly not by anyone standing next to it. We do not know exactly how this was accomplished. Also, the simplest method is to observe the rotation of the two selected stars around the celestial North Pole. When one is directly above the other, then the observer watching them is facing north. The stellar alignment itself connects the north shaft from the King's Chamber to Tubang. Not an unusual bright star, though, at the solstice and at the time of the closest things to the Egyptians has to a pole star, while the orientation to solstice or the sun general's rising and setting points are common both Egypt not only, but Egypt itself. Only 8 of the approximately 90 known pyramids have been surveyed. And even so, those that have are all constructed to face the cardinal points. Egyptologists' resistance to astronomical investigation so far means that we have no data on any others. The Egyptians were deeply concerned with the point of sky we know as the North Celestial Pole. It is the hub around which the night sky revolves, and while some stars rise and set every night, those close to the North Celestial Pole, such as the Big Dipper, never set, at least not when viewed from the Northern Hemisphere. To the Egyptians, they were therefore the indestructibles, those who know no tiredness or no destruction, perfect symbols of immortality. They were the immortal pharaoh's kingdom. Pyramid text spell 269 reads, "He, Atum, assigns the king to those gods who are clever and wise, the indestructible stars." To align a pyramid to this point of the sky was therefore to make a bold statement that whatever and whoever is connected with this building, namely the Egyptian state and its pharaoh, will live forever. There is nothing remarkable about this. Every empire suffers from the same conceit. In any case, the alignment of the king's northern shafts with the northern point removes all doubts. One kivet which has not been mentioned in the discussion of the shafts is that no other pyramid possess them, so we cannot take a large sample and ask how many points at certain or indeed any stars. However, the Great Pyramid is, by virtue of its gigantic size, a special case. Either way, it seems that Egyptian religion was directional. Face east to the rising sun and one is gazing the birth. Look west to the setting sun and one contemplates death. And stand with one's back to the south and front to the north and one is confronted with eternity. In view of the central position the sun occupies in the religion, we will expect the Egyptian temple to be constructed with fairly pronounced solar alignments. This is hardly a controversial suggestion. After all, Christian churches are generally aligned with the east. The notion was apparently first suggested by the German professor H. Nissen in 1885 and taken up in some detail by the same Norman Lockyer, who was to go on and study in the British megalithic sites. However, we find the same conflict of methodologies operating as in the surveys of the pyramid and megaliths. Lockyer relied too heavily on astronomical data, assuming a priori that this will help him and help in his stated goal, determining an exact chronology. However, he came up with dates such as a foundation of the first temple of Karnak of 3700 BCE, as opposed to the probable date of 1900 BCE, which defy the archaeological and textual evidence, while with a few exceptions, such as E.A. Wildspatch, the Egyptologists themselves were repelled by the intrusion of an outsider into their realm. However, Lockyer's assumption that monuments such as the Great Temple of Amun-Re at Karnak may be aligned with the summer solstice sunrise are perfectly reasonable. It is known, for example, that the entrance pylons to many temples reflected the sun's diurnal cycle by incorporating into their design the hieroglyph Aket, Orison. It means Orison. The significance of the Orison can hardly be overestimated. It was the boundary between the world of the living and the dead. When the sun set, the world went into mourning. And when it was reborn, there was joy. It was like Easter and Christmas every day. On this basis, Richard Wilkson embarks on a flight of a fancy concerning the temple's function. The temple stood as the nexus of the three spheres of heaven, earth, and the netherworld, and it served as a kind of portal by which gods and men may pass from one realm to another, in the same way that the temple pylon functioned symbolically as an aket or orison. In terms of the solar cycle, so the whole temple functioned as a kind of temporal and spatial aket, just as the physical orison is the interface between heaven and earth. And in terms of the setting sun between today and tomorrow, the present and future, this world and the beyond. So the temple of whatever type was regarded as an aket or interface between these spheres of or realms and was often described as such. The temple was more than a place of worship. By embodying in its very structure the measures of time and space, balancing the certain present and the uncertain future, it solidified the relationship between the divine and earthly states and facilitated, if not guaranteed, the maintenance of order and security. However, in spite of the widely accepted inclusion of cosmological principles in the Egyptian temple, Egyptologists ignore Lockyer's ideas, and it was left first to Paul Bargett and then the astronomer Gerald Hawkins, fresh from formulating his eclipse theories at Stonehenge, and Ed Krupp to repeat Lockyer's claims, rejecting some but confirming others. Hawkins, for example, concluded that what Lockyer calculated was a summer solstice alignment at Karnak was in fact a winter one, which, while contradicting certain of Lockyer's other claims, Ed Krupp's 1982 survey, meanwhile, has confirmed the existence of winter solstice alignments at a series of Mayan sites such as Karnak, as well as the mortuary temple of Hatshepsut near Luxor. However, as students of Northwestern European megaliths have discovered, it is sometimes misleading to look for precise solstice or equinox alignment. Sometimes some sites may be oriented to the sun on other significant day. Thus, while the chapel of Re Orakti at Abu Simbel is aligned to the winter solstice sunrise, the main temple is oriented to sunrise on 22 October and 18 February in our era. October 22 may have corresponded to New Year's Day